This is Phil Windley from IT Conversations. Today, it's my pleasure to bring you another edition of Tech Nation with Dr. Moira Gunn.
If you've always been curious about Audible.com but never tried it, now you can download a free audiobook and help support the Conversations Network in the process. Just go to audiblepodcast.com/CN and audible.com will donate to the Conversations Network in your name. That's audiblepodcast.com/CN. Our audio files are delivered by Limelight Networks, the high-performance content delivery network for digital media.
And now, here's the host of Tech Nation, Dr. Moira Gunn.
From San Francisco, I'm Moira Gunn, and this is Tech Nation. Today on Tech Nation, I speak with Kim Krieger about her book, Traveling Blind, Adventures in Vision, with a guide dog by my side.
Hello, I'm Jason Ponton, the editor-in-chief of Technology Review, MIT's magazine that focuses on the future of technology. We're proud to underwrite Tech Nation. Our award-winning magazine features cutting-edge articles, and breaking tech news appears every day at technologyreview.com.
In 1996, Susan Krieger was diagnosed with birdshot retinochoroidopathy. I asked her, what does that mean?
That's my eye condition. I have a birdshot retinochoroidopathy, which is a rare autoimmune eye disease that causes inflammation on my retina and my choroid. And that results in my having blind spots in my central vision area straight ahead in which I just don't see. For instance, if I look at a piece of paper with print on it, there'll be big holes in that print. And areas in my peripheral vision that are blind spots. So if I'm walking down a street and something is coming from my left or right or above or below, I can bump into it, be hit by it, trip on it, let's say a curb. And I have other distortions in my vision. I see wavy lines instead of straight ones. Sometimes I have double vision. Vision is much darker than usual, blurrier, things are missing, and all these distortions and irregularities and blind spots in my vision make it dangerous for me in terms of mobility and getting around. And this is where a guide dog has come in very useful.
Absolutely. Artila, the guide dog, she's right here. So if people hear little jingle jangles and everything, that's Tila.
Yes, that would be her leash and harness. She's dutifully being a guide dog, lying very still.
Now, I want to point out that my Microsoft Word thought it was a misspelling when I typed out retinochoroidopathy. So it must be rare.
Yes, it is. It is rare, and it doesn't have a cure or an obvious cause. But it's something that varies in individual cases and that I've had for about 10 or 12 years now.
And it's going to continue to worsen?
It continues. It gradually worsens over time. There's swelling and scarring in my retina and choroid, but having all the aids I do, the dog, I have a computer that speaks, I have become very adjusted to it, so it's almost second nature to me now.
Well, it doesn't matter how your sight is impaired or to what degree. Once it is, that experience is central to all people who have lost any sight. And that's one of the amazing things about this book. I mean, let's just start. This is Traveling Blind, and it's Traveling with Tila. Your retelling of your first trip on an airline, just you and she, that was eye-opening is what that was.
Yes. The title of the book is Traveling Blind, Adventures in Vision with a Guide Dog by My Side. And I began to write it soon after I came home with my new guide dog. My vision had worsened. I had used a cane, then wanted to get a guide dog, then finally went to the guide dog training school where I lived for a month, and I came home with a lively golden retriever, yellow Labrador cross named Tila. And she has the temperament of a golden retriever. She's a party dog. She would love to go off and play at any moment, and the dutifulness of a Labrador. So we're at home, and the book begins 2 months after I've come home with her. I go off on a trip with my partner and my new guide dog, and we're heading to the desert in southwestern New Mexico. And to do this, we have to get on an airplane. In the book, I have a chapter called Airport Stories, which begins with that trip and covers quite a few subsequent trips in which Tila and I confront the vagaries of security. How to get through security with the guide dog, remaining intact, still having our luggage, how to enable Tila to go to areas where she can relieve outside of airports. And I know that navigating security is difficult for anyone. And in this chapter, I can speak a little more about it if you like.
I'd like to.
I have many humorous stories about what happens to us.
Or not so humorous.
Not so humorous.
I mean, you had reserved an exit row so that Tila could sit on the floor in front of you. And when you arrived at the airport, what happened?
I had reserved an exit row, a bulkhead seat. The bulkhead seat in the airplanes has more room at the feet for a guide dog to lie.
Oh, you mean just at the very front row?
But at the front row, a bulkhead seat.
But it turned out to be an exit row.
And it turned out, when I arrived at the airport, that this bulkhead row was an exit row. This was my first airline trip with my new guide dog, and I was not aware at the time that the airlines have a rule that a person with a guide dog cannot sit in an exit row. And a blind person would have a guide dog. And I was busy arguing that I needed the bulkhead seat. I had reserved it. It had been given to me. And I was a bit miffed that they didn't think that a blind person could read and follow directions and help other people off the plane in an emergency. And I had visions of my dog helping and leading everyone off the plane, and we would really save the day. But over a bit of time, the airline people were very insistent, and it was their rule that I could not sit in the bulkhead row if it was an exit row. So I learned that lesson. Subsequently, I have requested bulkhead row and been very careful to make sure that even the person who assigns the seat doesn't neglect and put me in a row that's also an exit row, because I'll be bumped to another seat. But I was insisting on my rights, independent of, you know, what actually was the case in terms of the airline regulations.
Now, I think eventually they gave it to you, and then they didn't give it to you.
In this story, yes. They gave it to me and then didn't give it to me and put me in a regular seat, and then I was no longer disabled, so my partner could not meet me at the other end of the airport on my return trip, because you could only meet a person who was disabled, and I had lost my disabled status by no longer being in the disabled seating but a regular seating. It was confusing. Since that time, I've learned how to make things work out for myself a bit better.
But I think there's so many lessons here, and for all of us who, for one reason or another, we're in the middle of sort of like this airline hell. Is that what you want to do? And you finally say yes, and then you realize, but it undid all this other stuff.
Yes.
And it's extremely difficult, and here you are, being, you know, partially sighted, and you have your guide dog, and it's must be a really difficult thing just to be able to try to navigate wherever you are. You actually finally get off the plane, and nobody's there to meet you.
Right. Yeah, that was the situation at that time. Airports are a challenge. You know, I've learned over time, especially there's always that moment of going through security at the start, where you go up to the long counter where people are waiting, and I have to bend down and take off my boots and settle my dog down and put everything into trays, and they go forward and all this. And the big moment is when I approach the scaffolding, where you're going to go through the metal detector and all this. And at first, when I had my guide dog, which was a few years ago, the airport staffs were not as familiar, I think, with service dogs and guide dogs, so they truly didn't know what to do. And I had to learn by doing. The instructions that I got in my guide dog training were that I walk through that scaffolding with my dog first, my big golden retriever, and I walk through, and she has metal in her harness and in her collar, and this will set off the alarm. Then I ask her to lie down on the other side of the scaffolding. She, very obedient, dutifully lies down, looks straight at me. I walk back through the scaffolding to the other side, drop her leash, tell her to stay, walk forward, and hopefully don't set off the alarm. And then supposedly we would be free to go. But with the dog, there's then another step. They have always wanted to pat the dog down, to touch her all over and feel in case she has something hidden in her fur. And one of the things in her training that I learned was, walking on the street, anywhere I go, people should not touch my dog. Because especially this happy-go-lucky golden retriever that I have, she would want to pull me up to every person on the street or in the airport and say, pet me, play with me. And a guide dog needs to have her attention very riveted, straight ahead, to guide me around obstacles, to stop at changes in elevation like curbs. And so I arrive at the airport and they want to feel her all over. And I, my very first experience, I just barked at them, "No, you cannot touch my dog." I don't know where I got the nerve to do it, but...
You certainly don't speak to Tila that way.
No, but from there it began a way that we have dealt with it. Now, I asked them, "You can look under her, you can look all around her, I'll take off her harness and all this." And so they can take the harness, they'll wand it, they'll put it through the x-ray machine, sometimes they'll dust it. And I've asked them to look under her and look around her. And that is what I've been able to have them do. She's a very short-haired dog. She's very short-haired for both a lab and a golden retriever, so it would be visible underneath her and around her whether there's something hidden on her. But every time we hit it, I know their hands arriving and they want to touch her. And I've had to explain that she's a very high-strung dog and she'll think they want to play with her, and then I'll have trouble later on in the airport. Though sometimes, at the beginning especially, I know I once said to one of the attendants who wanted to, I said, "I don't know if she'll bite. I don't think she'll bite." And they just backed up and didn't. No, she wouldn't bite us all. But subsequently, it's been enough to say she's a very high-strung dog, and this would be very distracting for her. And she has short hair, I think you can see.
When you walk through an airport, you say you have to be careful because sometimes she'll sort of walk you into people or have you bump people because she doesn't see them as immovable objects.
Right, right.
Now tell us about that, the movable versus immovable objects.
Well, yes, as a guide dog, Tila is taught to take me around. Let's say I'm walking down the street and there's a scaffolding or there are garbage cans or there are any sort of thing that people have left out, or I'm going through a room and there's furniture. She will guide me around it and stop at changes in elevation. Somehow in airports, my dog, now all guide dogs are different. Some are much more calm. Mine is totally calm and dutiful in harness when she's working, but her temperament is very lively. She is very excited in this airport. You have a big place to run, you have people, you have smells, and she wants us to barge forward. And if there are people that we're moving by, she'll weave me around them. But somehow to her, they're not quite the same as a scaffolding or a garbage can. She expects them a little bit sometimes to step aside a little bit. And I'm holding her harness in my left hand, so I'm a little bit off to her right in the rear. And a guide dog has to assess what is the width of that dog plus the person. And if we get to too narrow an area, she needs to stop and tell me that we can't both fit. Well, I think people move very quickly in airports, so she won't always assess that there's enough room on her right-hand side for me and a little room on my right-hand side. So occasionally I will bump a person with my right shoulder. It's not that often, but it is her exuberance because it is a pretty exciting place.
Now, what I've observed is that you give Tila verbal commands. Is that your typical way of communicating with her?
Yes, I give verbal commands and body language commands. When we're walking in an area where I'm simply behind her, I can say halt, left, right, stop. But there are many maneuvers that we do that I also give signals. For instance, stopping at a corner, we stop at a curb, and then I say forward, and I have a movement of my right hand upright and a turn of my body, one that indicates right, one that indicates left. She knows left and right verbally, but the body language signals are always helpful. In addition, so whenever possible, I think I do use a combination of signals. And I've had her for some time now so that I think she reads my body language. It's a signal even when I don't intend it sometimes.
I was thinking, you know, in some of these places, they're very loud. So how she would hear it could be difficult.
Yeah. Yeah, that's correct. So there is some reading of the body language.
Just one little vignette in the book. You are somewhere in New Mexico. A good part of this happens traveling in New Mexico. And you have seen this placemat, which is so wonderful and beautiful. And your partner said, "You would never pick. This is just tasteless, basically." I was so struck by that because we're so identified by our taste. You know, this is my taste. And here you are, you're looking at something that when you were fully sighted, you would never have picked. That must be very disorienting.
Yes, it is, I think. To back up a little and give a little background for that, in Traveling Blind, I go on various adventures in the countryside, and the first is a trip to a mountain in the southern part of New Mexico, a trip to the desert. And one reason that the desert has interested me, even with my loss of sight, is that there are broad expanses, big sky, big mountains, big clouds, and whereas I've lost a great deal of fine line detail, and there will be a lot of holes in my vision, things I don't see, and distortions, when the expanses are big, I can get a nice feeling of the color and the shapes and all this. And so I much enjoy that. And this vignette you're talking about was at a time when we're stopping in a small souvenir Indian-Mexican shop, and there are different things for sale. Now, I go up to a placemat that has probably a very bold picture of a mountain, a coyote, a sun, or something like that, bright and colored, and I say, oh, this is beautiful. And it's really the cheapest looking thing. My partner comes up to me and says, it's really in very bad taste. You cannot give this to your sister as a gift. And I have a bit of hurt feelings at that time because I was really enjoying this, the bold shapes and colors, and I didn't want that enjoyment to be taken away from me. At the same time, I do say to my partner, you know, don't feel sad for me, because she said, I feel sad for you because you've lost so much vision. You never would have even picked up that thing before. I said, don't feel sad for me. Be happy because I'm enjoying what I see. Just don't let me buy it if you think it's in bad taste. And this was also, if I might add it, we were in this shop. It was a trading post, actually, and I have my dog. And having a guide dog, I found, brings out a lot of friendliness in the public, or people talk to me. And one of the proprietors of the store seemed to have run home while the time we were there, come back and brought a little golden retriever puppy that she had just to show and to meet my dog. And it was very moving to me. People's friendliness and willing to connect with me has been very moving.
You call this an invisible disability.
Yes. My blindness is an invisible disability. It is my impression that many, many people have some degree of blindness and that it is just not easily seen. You know, if I walk with a guide dog or I walk with a cane, that will be a signal that I am blind to whatever degree. But if I don't walk with one of these signals, it won't be visible. And even the fact that I walk with a guide dog, my disability, my blindness can still be invisible to others. For instance, there's a chapter in the book that I have titled, Are You Training That Dog? Because as soon as I came home with my guide dog, I found that quite frequently on the streets, even in San Francisco, I would be asked by someone, are you training that dog? And at first, I thought, uh-oh, I've come home from guide dog school and I'm not doing it right. I must be not stopping properly at the curves. My signals must be off or whatever. And I practiced a little, made sure I was doing okay. I thought, still, the question, are you training that dog? And after a little while, it got to me. But I realized that even though I had this dog signaling that I was blind, and she's guiding me, and I'm following her, and, you know, they weave on the streets. I don't get to choose the path I go from one curb to another. I walk like a dog. She follows the edge, and I go along. And my impression was that even though I had the signal that I was blind, people were perceiving me as possibly sighted because I did not fit stereotypes of a blind person, I think. I think, or especially of a blind woman, you know, maybe I was too competent. I didn't trip and fall and waver. I had been trained too well with my dog. And so perhaps they were a bit uncertain and they were asking me, are you blind or are you sighted? But the way it came out was, are you training that dog? So I was invisible, perhaps, as a blind person, even with my signal.
You say when you ask directions of people, they frequently give you sighted cues, like look for this sign, look for the big red, whatever. It's like, you've got to be kidding.
Yes, that is correct. And in the chapter on airport stories, this is very noticeable, where we are, I think, disembarking in the Atlanta airport, which is a very confusing and big airport. And I need to get to a place where my dog can go out and relieve herself, and I need some assistance at the gate. And I stop there, and I've already put in a request, can someone meet me and give me some assistance? Come to the gate. They say, I'm sorry, we're understaffed. No one can help you. I say, well, can you call customer service? They say, no, we can't call customer service, but you can go there. How do I get there, I ask. And the person points into the distance, and I have to say, I can't see where you're pointing to. Can you give me a little more specific directions? And then they kind of give a direction, and then they point again. And then you go this way, and then you take a left, and you'll be, and I have to say, and then after my left, exactly what will be the right, what will be this, what will be that, because I'll need the specificity of the direction. So there's often pointing and a general direction, and it's very common. So it's hard, though. What I have found is that people are not accustomed to the specificity that a blind person might need in order to get directions. And I'm not sure if they think sometimes, well, you just tell the dog, find customer service, and she'll go straight ahead. But the people are not that accustomed to the specificity of directions that a blind person needs. So I have to speak up for myself and say, this is exactly what I need. And that's a hard thing to do, I think, especially for women, but for me, is to assert oneself and ask for what you need, where the other person doesn't automatically know that, because people won't know it.
Well, airports are just everyday life. When you're traveling, you're going to find yourself in strange places. I was really moved by how many times you find yourself just being frightened. You know, it's a staircase. You're in a room. It's like you have no way of really figuring out, you know, how to navigate or how to be safe there.
Right. That is a common experience. And I have a story of crossing borders where my guide dog Tila and I and my partner Hannah are in the very south of New Mexico near the Mexican border. And we decide we'd like to go across to a border town for lunch. And we set out, and the three of us, and I think that was my very first trip with Tila, we go across from the American side to the Mexican side, and I have been taught in my training about how to stop at each curb, step down, tell the dog forward, go across the street, step up the up curb, go forward, and all this. And we go across the border, and all of a sudden, the curbs are irregular, the sidewalk is cracked, you step down off one curb, go across the street, there's no other curb, it's in some other place, there are things on the sidewalk for sale, there are a lot of people around, it's a border town. And I was terrified. And I was terrified both that I might trip and fall, but what would happen if I would trip and fall, I feared, was that someone would come and steal my new guide dog. And I was embarrassed that I was so afraid. You know, it's just Mexico. It's not that far. We walked across. But I process that a bit later, and I talk about it in the book to try to say, why was I so afraid? And one answer was about my dog. And the other sign was that I had underestimated that when I would cross that geographic border into another country, I would also cross a psychological border, a border to do with my blindness, into unfamiliar territory.
Now, the last time you were here, we talked about you're using a PC. You were saying earlier your computer talked to you. And oh, what a mess with Windows and pictures.
Yeah.
It's like, what is, you know, it's really hard. In the intervening several years, how's the computer world, how's technology been treating you? Has anything changed? Has it improved? Has it degraded?
I'm sure it has improved. Yeah, I use a screen reader called JAWS. There are several of them that speaks all the text aloud and all the dialog boxes, every key you press, a program operating at the same time as the other programs that I use. I think web pages have become somewhat better in that many of them are more easy to navigate with the screen reader, but this web pages especially are still most often a challenge. They are very visually organized, and it is hard to understand everything that's on a page and to get from here to there. So one navigation is navigating with a guide dog through the world, and the other is navigating, let's say, the world of the internet, and that has come a good ways, but there's a long ways to go. I mean, a pet peeve that I have, I guess, is that I do believe that the major problem facing blind people is lack of equal access. And by that, I mean lack of equal access to information. That the world of print material, whether it's on the web or in books, is not equally accessible to blind people. And one of my goals with my books is to call attention to that, make sure that they are available in quite a few alternative formats. And every time I have a book published, I sort of confront this frustration that so much of the print world, including Google Books, are Google Books that are searchable by the sighted are absolutely inaccessible for the blind. And I hope that in their plans I've written to them that this is something that will change in the future. I believe that it will, but right now it's really frustrating. I feel very, you know, unequal, and I want to have this same equality. And that's what I wish for all blind people, that blind people can know as much about that outer world as sighted people do.
And I hope that your book is also coming out in audio.
Oh, yes. It is available right now through Recordings for the Blind and Dyslexic as an audiobook that members of RFBND or those who have a vision or impairment or dyslexia or any kind of impairment that keeps them from reading print can get in touch with Recordings for the Blind and Dyslexic and obtain an audiobook. It's also available right now as an accessible PDF and Word document from the publisher so that the screen readers used by the blind in computers can read these documents. And I actually worked with the press to make sure that the PDF and the words all will read beautifully with refreshable Braille or with the screen readers. And further information, I do have a website for the book that has the information about quite a few of the alternative formats that are available for the blind and how to obtain them.
And that website is?
That website is http://susankrieger.stanford.edu. It simply has no www because it's on the Stanford system. So it's http://susankrieger.stanford.edu.
And we'll have that click through on our site as well. So that will be terrific. Well, Susan, it's always a pleasure. Please come back. And I always say, see me anytime.
Thank you.
Maybe I'll change that. My guest today is Susan Krieger. The book is Traveling Blind, Adventures in Vision with a Guide Dog by My Side. It's published by Purdue University Press. More information about this interview is available at www.technation.com. For TechNation, I'm Moira Gunn.
You've been listening to the IT Conversations podcast edition of TechNation with Dr. Moira Gunn. Most editions of TechNation are recorded at the studios of KQED in San Francisco. TechNation is also available on over 200 public radio stations throughout the United States, as well as on Armed Forces Radio. Please check your local listings for time and availability.
The post-production audio engineer for this program was Paul Figiani.
My name is Phil Windley, and I hope you'll join me next time for another edition of TechNation here on IT Conversations.